This is Audible.
Brilliant Audio presents the unabridged recording of Bright Line Eating, The Science of Living Happy, Thin, and Free by Susan Pierce Thompson, Ph.D. Performed by Susan Pierce Thompson, Tanya Eby, Mel Foster, John Robbins, and Emily Sutton Smith. This audiobook includes a PDF of the charts and lists that accompanied the print edition. If you have purchased an audio CD version, look for the PDF on a separate disc. It appears as an additional file if you have purchased an MP3 CD or MP3 download version.
For David, and for you.
Foreword by John Robbins. I've been advocating for healthy food choices for more than 3 decades. I'm a best-selling author, I'm the president of the Food Revolution Network, and I've had the great privilege of helping millions of people to improve their diets and, in many cases, to turn their health and their lives around. Over these years, I've seen many people become inspired to eat in a new way. Some of them have succeeded and experienced health outcomes beyond their wildest dreams. But many others struggle to sustain food choices that they knew were in their own best interests. Despite having plenty of knowledge and willpower, they found themselves succumbing to addictive pulls. Despite their best intentions, they watched their health and even their self-esteem degrade in the process. And a question began to burn inside me. Why is it that, when it comes to food, so many people are unable to consistently act in their own best interests? Why is it that so many accomplished, caring, and intelligent people are eating their way to misery and premature death? As a neuroscientist, Susan Pierce Thompson has spent decades studying this very problem. Stunningly, incredibly, I believe she's actually cracked the code. Susan also walks and eats her talk. She's among the less than 0.1% of the population that has gone from being obese to slender and kept that weight off for more than 10 years. She's an adjunct associate professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester, president of the Institute for Sustainable Weight Loss, and founder and CEO of Brightline Eating Solutions. She's dedicated her life to helping people achieve the vibrant health and zest for life that can accompany permanent weight loss. The operative word being permanent, because, shockingly, there is not a single peer-reviewed scientific journal article that shows any weight loss program taking any cohort of overweight people and helping them to get down to a healthy weight and stay there. But if you look at Brightline Eating's data, you see that Susan has had a level of success that is nothing short of spectacular. In 2015 and 2016, my 350,000 member strong network collaborated with Susan in putting on a pair of 8-week courses. Between the two courses, we had 5,600 participants, the vast majority of whom joined the program hoping to lose weight. In 8 weeks, they combined to lose more than 90,000 pounds. When I see these kinds of results, 90,000 pounds lost in 8 weeks, I'm floored. And all the more so because I know that those numbers, as impressive as they are, don't include the substantial amount of additional weight participants continued to lose after the 8-week programs ended. And these are not just numbers to me. I think with gratitude of the many cases of diabetes that have been averted. I think with thankfulness of the many heart attacks and cases of cancer that have been prevented. I think with joy of all the people who are now more present in their lives because they feel more confident in their bodies and who can show up more fully for the people they love. Of course, most weight loss programs promise the moon. But the only one I'm aware of that even begins to achieve this level of success is Susan's. In fact, the contrast with other weight loss programs is not just striking, it's staggering. Here's what the preliminary data show. It appears that people in Susan's programs lose 2.5 times more weight, and they do so 7 times faster than people in the country's most popular weight loss program. And unlike that program, the Brightline Eating business model is not based on recidivism. It's based on people reaching their goal weight and sustaining that weight, living happy, thin, and free. Recently, I led a retreat at a hot springs healing resort in Oregon. Among the attendees were 8 people who had taken Susan's course. I invited them to tell the group how much weight, if any, they had lost using her program. I didn't know if they would choose to answer, nor did I have any idea, if they did, what they would say. All of them, in fact, chose to answer, and this is what they said. 45 pounds, 60 pounds, 75 pounds, 35 pounds, 50 pounds, 80 pounds, 65 pounds, 40 pounds. As these people spoke, they were smiling from ear to ear. Every one of them looked radiant, vibrant, and happy. In the last few years, I've had the great pleasure of getting to know Susan Pierce Thompson as a colleague and as a friend. Now, through this book, you will have the great good fortune of getting to know her and her amazing work. Congratulations. You are about to meet one of the most brilliant and extraordinary people on this earth. And if you're someone who has struggled with weight issues, you may very well be about to meet the answer to your prayers.
Preface. The obesity epidemic. Not a problem, a mystery in plain sight. Something is awry. Over the past half century or so, there's been a shift in how our bodies and brains react to food. As a consequence, as a species, we are getting fatter, and no amount of education or effort seems to be helping. The statistics are as bad as you think. Roughly 2 billion people worldwide are now overweight, and a full 600 million of them are obese. In the United States alone, 108 million people are on a diet. Now, that number comes from the U.S. weight loss and diet control market, which merely measures people actively spending money on diet-related products and services. It doesn't count all the people trying to eat less or get healthier on their own. And it's not just an American issue. Obesity is now a bigger problem in developing nations than malnutrition. The Middle East has some of the highest per capita rates of type 2 diabetes in the world, 20% of the adult population. The combination of a hot climate, prohibition on alcohol, and high disposable income results in people drinking bottled soft drinks, sometimes 4 or 5 sodas a day. Boom, type 2 diabetes. The consequences of this problem couldn't be more dire. 63% of people die prematurely from diet-related diseases, including heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and stroke. Over the next 20 years, the World Economic Forum estimates that developed nations will spend $47 trillion on diseases caused by the global industrial diet. We are eating ourselves sick and into the poorhouse. But here's the statistic that I want to focus on. Among the obese who try to lose weight, the failure rate is 99%. Literally. 99% do not succeed at getting slim. And for that precious 1% who do succeed, the triumph is temporary. The vast majority regain the weight over the next few years. The average dieter spends a whole lot of money and makes 4 or 5 new attempts each year with almost no hope of success. Now, this is all truly bizarre. Maybe we're not seeing it because we've become inured to the hopelessness of the struggle, but let's consider if this happened in a different domain. If colleges and universities only graduated 1% of their students, And researchers found that the other 99% of students were dropping out and re-enrolling 4 and 5 times each year while spending billions of dollars to do it? That would be front page news. We would be outraged. We would say something smelled fishy and we'd demand that it be fixed. We certainly wouldn't be thinking that the 99% were probably just lazy or weak-willed. No, there's something strange going on here, and we're clearly missing important pieces of the puzzle. I think we can all agree, and the research is very clear, that people are genuinely motivated to lose weight. They're spending enormous sums of money to do it. Few things are more desirable in our Western culture than being slender. So why can't people succeed? When I was overweight, I wanted to get thin with every fiber of my being. I was desperate to get that weight off. I remember the focus and intention I would put into each new attempt. I was always so sure that I would finally make it work. I would weigh myself, measure myself, write down my goals, stay up late reading about the food plan I was about to start, and then commence with fanfare and tons of enthusiasm. And it would work. I'd start to lose weight. Then there would be some kind of Twilight Zone time warp, and a few months later, I would be even fatter than before and rallying the effort for yet another attempt. What always happened between point A and point B? And why was I not really online and aware of the unraveling of that attempt? Let's go back to the fact about the 99% of people who fail to lose all their excess weight. First, it's strange that people are failing so badly. And second, it's strange that we're not noticing that it's strange. It's bizarre that this phenomenon is happening right under our noses and nobody is noticing. Why doesn't anybody seem to wonder why smart, capable, educated, successful, motivated people who really want to get slender just can't do it? I really want us as a society to understand that we do not have an obesity problem. We have an obesity mystery. The problem itself doesn't make any sense. There's no other field of endeavor that I'm aware of where intelligence, determination, talent, and capability have so little bearing on the outcome. When I was trying to lose weight, it totally baffled me that I couldn't do it because I was capable in so many other areas. I had earned a PhD in brain and cognitive sciences. I had good friends. I was happily married. I ran a marathon. I was fat when I ran that marathon, but I ran it nonetheless. I couldn't even jog to the mailbox when I first started, but I put my mind to it, and with some friends in graduate school, we trained hard and we did it. We ran a 26.2-mile marathon without taking a single walking step, and I lost 10 pounds. I had 60 pounds to lose, but I merely lost 10 of them. Exercise is not the answer. So what is? Well, that's what I'm going to explain in this book. I'm going to present you with information on how the brain blocks weight loss and exactly what you can do about it. Because there is a solution. Thousands of people in my Brightline Eating boot camps have used this method to lose weight, collectively over 300,000 pounds so far. And the number who have lost all their excess weight and are keeping it off continues to rise. I'm talking about people who have lived their entire adult lives excessively overweight, who are now thin, something they never imagined was ever going to be possible for them. Brightline Eating gave them hope again. It delivered on the promise. It solved the mystery. I wrote this book because I want everyone to have that solution. The information contained in these pages is vital to changing our cultural understanding of what being overweight is. Not a willpower deficit and not a moral shortcoming. Rather, the byproduct of a brain hijacked by modern food. And more crucially, I want to show you what a solution that works actually looks like. It's not about 6 small meals a day, free days, or even lots of exercise. I will teach you about bright lines, automaticity, and support. Bright lines are clear, unambiguous boundaries that you just don't cross, like a non-smoker just doesn't smoke. They work because they align with how the brain works. No one should have to suffer in a body that doesn't bring them joy. No one should spend a single additional minute feeling like a failure because conventional diets that don't work with our brain chemistry fail them. If you've almost given up attempting to lose weight because you're exhausted from trying so hard and not succeeding, if your health has become an issue and you've got to make a change, or if you just have a few pounds to lose and you really would like to shed them and keep them off, then I have good news. You can learn why your brain has been blocking you from losing weight and adopt a simple system that will permanently turn that around. You no longer have to feel lost in a flood of confusing and contradictory information on how to eat, or languish on the couch overeating late into the evening knowing you're choosing suicide on the installment plan, or feel like your weight is holding you back from finally living your dreams and being the person you were meant to be. Get ready to take back control of your brain and live your life as you never have before. Happy, thin, and free. Introduction. My story. Let me tell you a story. While sometimes colorful around the edges, I actually think it represents, at its core, the garden variety suffering of millions of people who are overweight, hooked on food, and desperate for a solution. After all I've lived through, I can say this. I have a very addictable brain. At one time or another, I've been on the merry-go-round with just about every addictive substance on the planet. And nothing, I mean nothing, is harder to kick than food. The beginning. One of my earliest memories from childhood is being given two marshmallows. I might have been four. My parents, two avowed hippies, were recently divorced and scraping together a living in San Francisco. He is a taxi driver, she in a small shop at Fisherman's Wharf selling imported alpaca sweaters and rugs they'd discovered on their motorcycle travels through South America. They both worked long hours trying to provide for me, and this was especially true during the summers when the shop stayed open until 9 p.m. During those long, hot months, I was often flown to stay with family friends on Sunshine Mesa in Colorado. I loved the horses, the ponds, and the fort on the side of the hill. I loved the attention I received from my parents' friends who hadn't been able to have children of their own yet. But mostly, I loved those marshmallows. I can remember the feel of them in my little hands, the powdery smell, the sunlight setting them aglow in my eagerly outstretched palms. Before long, I realized that they lived in the cabinet, that when the adults were out feeding the animals, I could drag a chair over to the counter, climb up, and surreptitiously help myself. This is my first memory of feeling compelled to eat more than I knew that the adults around me would condone, and the beginning of a long journey of hiding, sneaking, and stealing food. But what they offered outright, I also took full advantage of. On errand day, I'd jump to volunteer, slogging through a day of buying feed and standing around in the relentless heat because I knew that at some point we'd visit a store that sold candy. One day in town, I got a finger waggled in my face and a grown-up said, "You be careful, young missy. You're a sugar addict." I didn't really know exactly what that was, but somehow I knew that it fit. Once I got a little older, I became a latchkey kid. A latchkey kid who knew how to cook. By the age of 8, I could have made you Thanksgiving dinner, single-handedly, with all the dishes arriving hot to the table at the right time. On my mom's side of the family, there were true gourmets. My grandma Polly was a friend of Julia Child's, and she and my uncle Hafe would discuss the La Russe Gastronomique over wine at a dinner party and debate whether it was acceptable to use a white onion in place of a shallot in an emergency. I was proud that I didn't eat out of bags and boxes, that I cooked from scratch. But what started out as a love of baking and sharing time in the kitchen with my mom turned by age 9 into an obsession with raw cookie dough. I would come home from school and make a full batch with no pretense of baking it. I'd just sit on the floor in front of the TV with a bowl in my lap, eat until I felt sick, and then rush to clean it all up before my mother got home. Now, my mom was less into fancy food than healthy food. She loved astrology, yoga, and throwing the I Ching. And through her influence, I grew up on the nutritional philosophies of Adele Davis and Nathan Pritikin. The first time we decided together to really do the Pritikin diet, I was maybe 10. Neither of us had weight to lose at that point. It was just about being maximally healthy. I remember feeling empowered and excited, but I don't remember it lasting long. Right around that time, I experienced my first episode of serious depression. I was back at Sunshine Mesa, but unlike previous summers, I wasn't enjoying myself. I didn't want to pick cherries, trap grasshoppers in a jar, or do any of the things that I usually loved. All I wanted to do was sleep. Everyone thought I was homesick, but long tortured calls to my mom didn't help. We all breathed a sigh of relief when summer was over and I got to fly back home to San Francisco. Then, when I was 12 years old, I decided to go off sugar. I remember being excited about it and thinking carefully about what I would count as sugar. Would I eat honey, maple syrup, yogurt with fruit on the bottom? I drew a strict line and declared that if something even tasted sweet, I wouldn't eat it. Looking back, I now see that as my first bright line. And it stayed bright for longer than 2 months. And the main thing I remember about that time was that I felt great, totally empowered. And then one day, I was pulled in by a scintillating, sugary treat. I debated, telling myself that surely I'd been virtuous for long enough, and I ate it. Thus ended the no-sugar experiment. A year later, a new factor was thrown into the mix, puberty. And with it came body dissatisfaction. Now, somehow I'd made it to the age of 13 without really being concerned about my weight or my shape. But after puberty, that all changed. I was only 15 pounds overweight, but I carried it all around my middle. And compared to my petite little mom, I felt enormous. From then on, any further attempts at dieting were thwarted by my depression and isolation. In school, I was out of sync with my peers because my IQ tested high for someone twice my age, yet my social skills lagged way behind. I felt different and rejected. Food was my companion, my excitement, and oftentimes my only friend. But I think even had none of those things been true, my brain would still have been hardwired for addiction. Now, more, again. Spiraling down. My dopamine receptors were primed to need more than I could get from food. In the midst of my adolescent explorations, I found the only diet that ever seemed to really work. Drugs. When I was 14, a friend from summer camp offered me mushrooms at a UB40 concert. Against my better judgment, I tried them. We explored Tilden Park and then drove around until the sun came up. I had never felt so free, so connected with the universe, so effortlessly at home with other people. I collapsed into bed, and when I awoke 20 hours later, I padded across the hall to the bathroom and stepped on the scale. I had lost 7 pounds. My world tilted on its axis. I was hooked. Over the next 6 years, my life slowly spiraled out of control. My stellar grade school education came in handy. I was able to maintain a 4.0 with minimal effort and scanty attendance. Whenever my parents confronted me about my late nights or the money that had gone missing from my grandmother's purse, I just countered by telling them that my grades were great, my life was on track, I was fine. I was so not fine. Anything new I was introduced to, I wanted more of. Acid, ecstasy, cigarettes, alcohol, sex. There was never such a thing as enough. And when the drug dealer wouldn't answer his pager, when there was no money for nicotine, no fake ID to buy alcohol, there was always a big bowl of pasta or cookie dough to take the edge off. My weight continued to plague me. Then, in the fall of my senior year of high school, when I should have been in AP chemistry class, I met a guy playing pool in the middle of the day. We became inseparable, and within the first week, he offered me my first hit of crystal meth. That was it. I had found my solution. Suddenly, I could go days without getting hungry. Beyond not being hungry, I had zero interest in food. And I finally got thin. It was magical. Of course, I may have been thin, but I most definitely was not well. My guidance counselor saw me spinning away from my future, away from hope, and pulled me out of class one day and insisted that I fill out some paperwork for a program at UC Berkeley, a prestigious school, but also my local state school. Because of my accelerated test scores, I would automatically be admitted as a freshman in the fall if I could just graduate from high school and pass one class on the Berkeley campus during my senior year. At the time, when he shoved the papers under my nose, I scoffed at how little I thought I'd need them. I still assumed Harvard was in my future and had no idea how far drugs were about to take me from my path. Looking back, all I can say is, thank God. Things were crumbling fast. I couldn't seem to get out of bed to go to class anymore. But dropping out would nix my acceptance to Berkeley. So I found a loophole. I could take an equivalency test, which I did, on acid, and passed. And somehow I managed to get myself across the bridge to Berkeley and pass that one mandatory class as well, Introduction to Sociology. So I left a wedge in the door to my future and then ran in the other direction. I decided that my problems were America's fault, and I moved to Canada. To which I can only say to my 18-year-old self, okay. On the plus side, disconnected from my community back home, I did manage to get myself off crystal meth. Hold your applause. I was in no way sober yet, and over the cold, dark months, I stayed inside and gained 40 pounds. By smoking cigarettes and eating, wait for it, granola. I smoked cartons and cartons of cigarettes and ate boxes and boxes of granola. Finally, I realized my mistake and returned to California. By that point, my mother had sold her struggling shop and moved down to San Jose. I moved in with her and tried to assemble the fragments of my life into something that felt like it had some purpose, some direction. So I enrolled in San Jose City College and got a job at a movie theater selling popcorn. The theater's manager would freebase cocaine after work, and I wanted to try it. I knew it was dangerous, but I figured I'd been successful at kicking crystal meth, so I could handle myself. Within mere weeks, I graduated to smoking crack. The weight poured off, I felt like myself again, and I left my mom in San Jose and thought I'd have a fun summer back up in San Francisco. But it got worse from there. As I sank deeper and deeper into the abyss of the underworld, I funded my habit exactly the way you imagine a reckless 19-year-old girl might. I managed never to have to sleep outside, but having exhausted everyone's good graces, I was essentially homeless. Everyone around me was using substances, or using me, and I'd shut out the people who loved me most. Shortly after my 20th birthday, on a Tuesday morning in August, I finally hit bottom. I was in a seedy hotel in a slum on South Van Ness Avenue. I'd been there, smoking crack, for days. In one clear and poignant moment, I had a vision of who I'd become. It contrasted sharply with my childhood dreams of getting an Ivy League education and contributing something important to the world. Suddenly I knew that if I didn't get up and get out of there right then, I would never become anything more than I was at that moment. I got my jacket and I walked out the door. I went to a friend's apartment. He graciously let me in to sleep and shower. Refreshed, I put my pager on my hip, ready to go back to work. But as fate would have it, I had scheduled a date for that night with a cute guy who'd chatted me up at a gas station at 3 a.m. several days prior. Miraculously, despite the chaos in my life, I kept that date. And miraculously, instead of dinner and a movie, the first date he decided to take me on turned out to be a 12-step meeting for alcohol and drug addiction. Miraculously, I have abstained from drugs and alcohol since that blessed day, August 9th, 1994, a date that will forever be ingrained in my brain. I committed to my recovery as fervently as I'd taken to addiction. I went to meetings daily, completed the year at San Jose City College, finally re-enrolled at UC Berkeley, and graduated 2 years later, summa cum laude, with a 4.0 and a major in cognitive science. After my years of addiction, you could not have presented me with a topic I found more fascinating to study. I wanted to know how the brain worked and why one like mine could go so far off the rails. My in-depth study of the brain's reactions to food would come later, but the core curiosity began there. Academically, I had my life back on track. I had rebuilt trust with my family. But if you think we're anywhere close to a happy ending, I'm guessing you have no idea what it's like to live under the tyranny of food addiction. Nowhere near free. Of the thousands of students at UC Berkeley, I was selected to give the student keynote address at graduation for my division. It was an enormous honor, one that I'd clawed my way back from the brink to deserve. My parents were bursting with pride. But instead of being excited on graduation day, I was kneeling beside my bed crying. Why? Because I was fat. I'd known when I quit drugs that I would gain a ton of weight, but I'd forgotten how torturous it was to have to show up to places in a body that just made me want to hide. Losing weight sounded great in theory, but every time I sat down to write a paper, I brought along a bowl of comfort food for support. Sometimes that comfort food was simply a box of brown sugar and a spoon. One evening at dusk, I stood on a hill, looking down at the campus and the twinkly Golden Gate Bridge beyond, feeling utterly drained and exhausted, as if I had 100-pound weights strapped to my ankles, and I thought, this is what being poisoned feels like. And then I reached into the pocket of my oversized coat, pulled out a marshmallow, and ate it. And I did it again 30 seconds later, and 30 seconds after that. I couldn't stop. I couldn't even slow. Each time I tried to control my eating, it would culminate in a binge. Yes, my addiction to drugs had taken me to more dangerous places, but my addiction to food was proving to be even more painful and much more insidious. It hid in plain sight. I couldn't have snorted lines of crystal meth in the middle of campus, but no one called campus security when I ate those marshmallows. So I graduated and managed to make the cross-country move to the University of Rochester in New York, where leading research in the field of brain and cognitive sciences was being done. As soon as I got there, I fell in love with the work and with the community in my department. But control was gradually slipping beyond my reach. Overcome by the bleak, sunless winters, I started sleeping until late afternoon with laundry and dirty dishes piling up all around me. My binging escalated, as did my attempts to lose weight. At one time or another, I tried them all. Fit for Life, Body for Life, the Pritikin diet, again and again. Susan Powder's Stop the Insanity, the USANA Lean program, Weight Watchers, multiple times. The Raquel Welch Total Beauty and Fitness program, the Atkins diet, Dexatrim, Mindful Eating, and Ellen Satter's Competent Eating. I read Janine Roth books and tried listening to my body. I lifted weights. I ran a marathon. I went to personal therapy, group therapy, and hypnosis. I tried forgetting about losing weight and just focusing on loving myself more. And I attended endless, endless 12-step food meetings. Sometimes I'd march my binge foods out to the dumpster and throw them away with finality, pouring vinegar all over them lest I be tempted to come back and try to retrieve them later. But I could never seem to make the resolve last. One week in November, I binged so hard that an inflammatory fluid built up in my knees, and the next morning, I couldn't stand up. Literally, I called my dad, and he got me on a plane back to California and booked an appointment for me with a well-respected eating disorder specialist. She kindly and gently explained that the usual signals that the brain sends to tell us to stop eating didn't work for me, that my brain was wired differently. She showed me a pair of graphs from a recently published research article. One of the graphs showed a straight line. She said, when a normal eater sits down to eat a meal, she starts off hungry and gradually gets full. And then she pointed to the other graph, which showed a U-shaped curve. She said, when you sit down to eat a meal, you start off hungry, gradually get a little fuller, but then, midway through the meal, you start to get hungrier again. So that by the end of the meal, you're just as hungry as you were when you started. That made so much sense to me. I never seemed to get full. At the end of the appointment, she sent me on my way with a prescription for a very high dose of an antidepressant medication that she said would also help my eating compulsion. It didn't. So I prescribed my own course of treatment, one that I knew would work, bulimia. A year later, I met my husband, David. He was unconditionally accepting and supportive, oftentimes having more faith than I did that I was going to beat this. We got married, bought a little house right near campus, and blended his dog and my three cats into one big family. But soon we noticed that our newlywed habit of eating in restaurants all the time had expanded our waistlines, mine more than his. I didn't know it at the time, but I'd officially crossed an invisible but significant line. I was obese. So we committed to a bikini body challenge. We looked each other in the eye and swore that we would stay 100% committed and complete the 12-week challenge together. The plan included 6 days a week of prescribed meals and exercise. And Sunday was a free day when you could eat whatever you wanted. We followed the program strictly, and within weeks, David was back to being the lean and fit guy he'd been when we met. I, on the other hand, was going crazy. On the free day, while David ate his one burger, an order of fries, and a small dish of ice cream, just something to check that indulgence box and then get back to the routine Monday morning, I would eat everything that wasn't nailed down. And the rest of the week, the obsession was deafening. On Wednesday, we're having friends over for dinner, and I want to cook something amazing, so I think I'll transfer half my free day to Wednesday. But then on Sunday, if I can't stop eating halfway through the day, I'll have blown it. But I can do some extra exercise and get off those extra calories, and I'll be okay. Unless I won't have time to both exercise and drive to all the different restaurants and stores I'll need to visit to get all the food I'll want to eat before midnight comes and my free day is over. And if by the end of the free day, I've forgotten to eat something I really meant to eat, I'll have to wait a whole week, so I'd better... And on and on and on and on and on. I was supposed to be focusing on my dissertation, but I only had one radio station playing in my head, and it was tuned to all food all the time. Something about toggling between 6 days of control and what I was doing to my body on Sundays was mentally undoing me. The plan wasn't working for me. I had to give it up. Not only was I sickeningly disappointed in myself, but I felt like I was letting David down too. I had broken my word. It was clear to both of us that I was powerless over my relationship with food. But I also had my first clue. Something knocked at the researcher in my brain. Why did the free day work for David, but undo me? How exactly, quantifiably, were we different? I didn't have the answer yet, but I was finally asking the right question. Bright lines. I had been going to 12-step meetings for compulsive eaters since the fall of 1995, and while the community support had been profoundly helpful in terms of making me feel less alone, they weren't helping me get any better. It was now 2003, and I was just as miserable as ever. For one thing, my food plan was left entirely up to me, so inevitably I stayed hooked on sugar and flour. Desperate from the disappointment of failing, not only the bikini body challenge itself, but it felt like my marriage, I found another 12-step food program that did offer specific guidance about what to eat. I went to my first meeting on a Wednesday night in late May and decided to give it a try. Lo and behold, it worked. Within a few short months, I had a slender physique, a spring in my step, and joy bursting in my heart. I was finally free. I was sure I'd found the solution to the world's obesity epidemic, and I worked hard at spreading the word. Over time, though, I started doubting that this was a solution for the masses. First of all, I was being told that the program should come before family. Second, my meetings, phone calls, and service obligations, all part of the program, consumed more than 20 hours a week. And finally, there was a maddening arbitrariness and lack of scientific basis to many of the requirements and food rules. For example, at various times by various sponsors, I was told I couldn't eat soup, nuts, seeds, corn, peas, cherry, mangoes, grapes, beans, lentils, veggie burgers, or even mixed vegetables because they weren't simple enough. My husband got tired of it all and suddenly began questioning whether he wanted to stay married to me. Literally. I found a new sponsor, and that helped a bit, but he remained concerned on several fronts. My husband wasn't the only one put off by the intensive process. Only a minute fraction of the people I knew who needed to lose weight were willing to even give it a try. I didn't believe it then, but I can see now that this 12-step program was a good fit for only a very small segment of the population. Nevertheless, I remain eternally grateful to it. It provided exactly what I needed at the time, a mandate not to eat sugar or flour, ever. Once I was finally, truly off sugar and flour, my brain still took months to heal. The damage to my dopamine receptors was extreme, so they didn't just spring back into action. It wasn't spontaneous, but gradually the world did come back into color. Miraculously, the depression that had plagued me on and off since childhood disappeared completely, and I got off my antidepressants for good. I was thin, I was sober, I could think, I could function. I finished my dissertation. We moved to Australia, where I had landed a 2-year postdoctoral research and teaching fellowship in psychology at the University of New South Wales. After it ended, we moved back to America, and I became a tenured psychology professor. I started teaching a course on the psychology of eating. I returned again to that question I'd asked, back when I gave up the bikini body challenge. What was different about how my brain reacted to unstructured eating and how David's brain did? I immersed myself in researching the neuroscience and psychology of truly sustainable weight loss. I also began working with many people one-on-one, helping them to lose their excess weight and keep it off. Personally, I survived without the crutch of excess food through infertility treatments, extremely premature twins, a second surprise pregnancy, and all the other ups and downs of life on life's terms. Fast forward many years to a cold January morning. It was 5 a.m., and as per my usual morning routine, I was meditating. As I sat silently on my meditation bench, there appeared, in my heart and mind, a big, clear mandate. Write the book, Bright Line Eating. The information I had in my head could help so many. It needed to be shared. It could help change our cultural weight loss narrative from one of moderation and control to one of bright lines and freedom. I had been through the ringer, through years and years of pain, and over 20 years watching thousands succeed or fail in various kinds of food programs. I knew what didn't work and why, and I knew what did work and why. And I was lucky to have the academic background that allowed me to connect the dots. I could explain the science behind it all. I know there are millions of overweight and unhealthy people suffering in the world, praying for a solution. In the stillness that morning, I throbbed with their prayers and their need. The solution had to get out. The trouble was, my life was already completely full. After my 5 a.m. meditation session every day, I was then on the phone for 90 minutes, taking back-to-back 15-minute phone calls and food commitments from the myriad people I was helping to lose weight. Then David and I had to get our 3 little kids ready for daycare and school, and then I went off to work teaching college courses and mentoring students. But I knew this book had to be written. So the very next morning, I started rising at 4:25 a.m. to write my book proposal before my morning meditation. I was diligent and made progress, but as the weeks unfolded, I discovered that in order for the book to have the reach that I hoped it would, I needed to build a platform first. I couldn't even imagine finding the time to start a podcast or go on speaking tours. The only platform I could envision fitting into my life was an email newsletter. So I vowed to write an email once or twice a week that would help people understand the psychology and neuroscience of truly sustainable weight loss. So I did that. On August 5th, I launched it. By the end of the year, it had 800 subscribers. 6 months later, it had 10,000. 6 months after that, 100,000. And after another 6 months, 200,000. In short, the list grew from nothing to over 200,000 subscribers in less than 2 years, which is unusual in the extreme. And as the community grew, their needs grew. I began offering what I called boot camps. The first online boot camp had 40 people. I taught the material on live conference calls in the evenings after tucking my three daughters into bed and grading my college students' papers. Soon the online bootcamp registrations grew to thousands of people, and I created a full online course with video tutorials, the whole shebang. It became clear that I could no longer be a professor and serve the needs of this burgeoning movement. What was I to do? I had envisioned being a college professor until retirement. But Brightline Eating was helping so many people, relieving so much misery. The mandate to grow the movement couldn't be ignored. So I handed back tenure and dove all in. I hired a team, and together we started a research program to track the results we were seeing in the boot camps. From the research responses, we know that the average boot camper in 8 weeks loses 19 pounds. Many lose much more and keep going all the way to goal weight. As of the final editing of this book, we've helped people from over 75 countries lose over 300,000 pounds. We believe Brightline Eating is the most successful weight loss program on earth, and we are amassing data that backs that up. With this data collection effort and the success of the Brightline Eating program, a new opportunity emerged. I was invited to become an adjunct associate professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester, my grad school alma mater. We are mapping out an ambitious research agenda, the outline of which is laid out in Chapter 15 at the conclusion of this book. And just recently, my Brightline Eating team and I set what we call our Everest goal. It's big and it's outrageous, but I think we'll do it. By 2040 or before, we want to help 1 million people get all the way down to goal weight and stay there permanently. 1 million people finally living happy, thin, and free. It's been a wild ride, but at its core, it's pretty simple. The modern diet wires our brain to work against us, but we can rewire it to work for us. We are not weak. We are not stupid. We are simply trapped on a chemical hamster wheel and haven't been given the tools to get off. Until now. In part one of this book, I will give you all the science you need to understand what is happening inside your brain that is blocking your weight loss, and how the standard American diet hijacks our hormones and our neurotransmitters, leaving us with insatiable hunger, overpowering cravings, and vulnerable to something I call the willpower gap. Then, in part two, I will explain how Brightline Eating solves those problems by literally rewiring your brain to work with your goals, not against them. I will introduce you to the four bright lines that will change your life and end your dieting cycle forever. Sugar, flour, meals, and quantities. And I'll give you the formula for integrating them into your life in a way that takes the burden off willpower completely. In part three, I will give you the Brightline Eating food plan. It's hugely varied because I want to make your weight loss as painless as possible. It's also easily adaptable for any regime you already follow, whether you're a vegetarian, vegan, paleo, gluten intolerant, have a specific health condition, or need to avoid specific foods, Brightline Eating will absolutely work for you. Parts 4 and 5 are about empowering you with tools that make long-term weight loss a sustainable reality. That's the Brightline Eating difference. We don't tell you what to do and then leave you to figure out how to stick with it over the long term. We are with you every step of the way for as long as you need us. I've been thin for well over a decade, and I still enjoy the support of this community literally on a daily basis. Brightline Eating ushers in an end to cravings, an end to dieting, an end to that constant, exhausting, soul-sucking loop in your head about food and calories and exercise and pounds. I have no interest in getting you thin if you're not also going to be happy and free. Living happy, thin, and free is your birthright. I do it. My boot campers are doing it. And you can too. So join me. Join me and the countless others who are walking arm in arm on this glorious path. Whatever your background, however much you have or haven't suffered with food, Whether you're hundreds of pounds overweight, just a few pounds overweight, or in a right-sized body already, but crazy with food obsession, we hold the vision of your highest future, your happiest, healthiest, most actualized self. We want you to get happy, thin, and free so that you can be liberated to do what you're here on this earth to do without being held back by your weight or your relationship with food. You have gifts to give, a purpose to fulfill, and we want you living it. If I can break free, anyone can. I have no doubt you've got this. So, thank you for letting me share my story. And now, buckle in, because Bright Line Eating is about to change your life. With love, Susan. Part 1. How the Brain Blocks Weight Loss. Chapter 1. The Willpower Gap. So, what is happening to those 108 million dieting Americans I mentioned in the preface? The people unsuccessfully trying to lose weight, some 4 and 5 times every year. I posit, and the science supports, that their brains are blocking them from losing weight. But why, you might ask? Why would it do that? It seems contrary to the idea that our bodies can monitor, regulate, and heal themselves. Well, probably, under normal evolutionary circumstances, they could have. But our modern times have changed many of our behaviors and circumstances. Research shows that modern foods and modern patterns of eating are hijacking 3 critical processes in our brain and rendering sustainable weight loss nearly impossible. The purpose of Bright Line Eating is to reverse these processes and get the brain back on board with our weight loss goals. The reason that someone who commits to Bright Line Eating and stays with it loses that excess weight and keeps it off long term is that on Bright Line Eating, the brain and the body work in concert with one shared goal: living happy, thin, and free. Over the next 3 chapters, I'm going to describe these 3 critical processes one at a time, and the rest of the book will be devoted to explaining the solution. It's vital that you not just skip this section and jump ahead to the food plan because your neighbor already lost 100 pounds and gave you the book and you just want to do it already. No, you need to fully understand what is happening inside your brain. Fully understand why Bright Line Eating will work where your other attempts have failed. In this chapter, I'm going to start by talking about something that most people think they already understand. Willpower. What is willpower? We often think of willpower as an aspect of our moral character, or as a tool that gets more effective with increased commitment. How do we use it? We marshal it. This common phrase reveals our bias. It suggests that all the willpower we need is there, waiting for us to mobilize, rally, raise, and summon it. If we fail to exert the effort, then shame on us. But willpower isn't what you think it is, and it doesn't work how you think it works. Every January, millions of people in the United States start diets. Emails flood inboxes, ads flood the internet, every magazine and daytime news show is talking about the latest fad diet and exercise program, and people psych themselves up that this time it's going to work. What people don't realize is that these diets are designed to rely on your willpower to be effective. They outline what to eat, what not to eat, how to exercise, and why, and then they leave you to manage execution over the long term. This is why gyms are packed in January and attendance levels fall back to normal in February. This is why by spring, the average American is already starting his or her second diet. I've asked college students in my classes on introductory psychology and the psychology of eating how they would define willpower. The majority mistakenly believe it's either something in your personality that you're born with or a barometer of inherent moral fiber. And actually, it's neither. Willpower is a simple brain function. And while studies have shown that there is a genetic component to how strong it is, there is a lot more to it than genes. It's important to understand that willpower is not merely a mental faculty that resists temptation. It also governs other things, like the ability to focus. It monitors our task performance, regulates our emotions, and most important, helps us make choices. Have you ever thought to yourself at the end of the day, I cannot make one more decision? You tell your spouse or your roommate to choose dinner or pick the movie because you just can't. That's what scientists call decision fatigue, and it's real. Roy Baumeister is a professor of psychology at Florida State University and arguably the world's leading expert on willpower, or ego depletion, as he calls it. In 1998, he co-authored a paper in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology that put willpower on the map as a subject of scientific inquiry. In the article, he describes what is now famously called the radish experiment. Participants were told to fast overnight and arrive hungry at the lab the following morning. They were directed into a room that was filled with the aroma of freshly baked cookies. Then the subjects were asked to sit at a table on which there were two things, a bowl filled with raw radishes and a plate brimming with chocolate chip cookies and chocolate candies. One group was told they could eat the radishes while filling out a questionnaire, but were warned not to touch the cookies or candies because they were going to be used in another study. A second group was told that they could eat the cookies and candies, but to please not touch the radishes. And a third group didn't find any food in the room at all. Each participant was given about 15 minutes to complete the questionnaire, then was taken into the adjacent room where they were told they would then do the actual study. They were led to believe it would be an intelligence test. In reality, it was a set of impossible geometry puzzles. Researchers noted how many attempts the participants would make and how long they would persist in trying to solve them. Now, the participants who'd just been resisting the cookies for 15 minutes had little willpower left to force themselves to work on those impossible geometry puzzles. They quit after just 8 minutes. But participants who were allowed to eat the cookies and the control subjects who encountered no food at all persisted in working on those impossible geometry puzzles for nearly 19 minutes, even though they were insolvable. They just kept trying. They had the willpower. This was the first experiment where researchers realized, whoa, willpower is actually a thing. Really, until 1998, scientists didn't know that willpower was measurable. What Baumeister went on to prove is that exerting self-control in one area of our lives uses up this precious, finite resource and prevents further regulation of other functions. Now, it's vital to understand this because most of us naturally have only about 15 minutes of self-regulatory capacity available at a time. 15 minutes. Can you imagine if your phone had only 15 minutes of charge? And a whole host of activities and stressors deplete it, particularly the kinds of things that most of us do all the time, like check email. You may not consciously realize it, but every email you receive requires your brain to make a host of decisions. Delete it, read it, store it, reply, all, now, later, how. Emotional regulation also depletes willpower very quickly. For example, picking up your kids from school, getting them home, through their activities and homework, then dinner, bath time and bedtime, and squabbles and whining without losing your patience. That depletes willpower big time. How many times do we want to go straight from turning out our child's bedside lamp to the kitchen? You're not imagining that connection. The link is brain glucose. One study showed that inmates coming up for parole had only a 15% chance of getting paroled if their parole judge was due for a break, and presumably a snack. After the break, their odds went up to 65%. How does all this work? Willpower in the brain. The seat of willpower in the brain, is the anterior cingulate cortex. The anterior cingulate cortex sits right behind the prefrontal cortex, which is the seat of rational decision-making in the brain. The entire brain runs on glucose, but the anterior cingulate cortex is especially sensitive to glucose fluctuations. When brain glucose levels drop, activity in this area slows to a crawl.